ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
And this is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day there, my name's Matt Brand. Welcome to the program. An award-winning farmer has been jailed over an $8.7 million water fraud. I'll share the details of this landmark case with you in just a moment. Also this afternoon, some good news for mango growers and consumers. Researchers say they've found a cheap and easy way to extend the shelf life of mangoes by an extra 2 weeks. And before 1:30 this afternoon, as the price of gold rises, there's plenty of prospectors grabbing the pans, grabbing the metal detectors, and heading out into the territory in hopes of striking it rich.
There's a lot of gold coming in, but people are scattered everywhere across the territory. There's a lot of people with leases. There's a lot of people out at Margaret Diggings and those sorts of places. Now it's the season, so don't really hear much.
Ooh, we've got all sorts of things on the Country Hour this afternoon. And if you've tuned in and you've found the odd nugget in the NT, you don't need to tell us exactly where you found it. We're not after your secrets, but we are after your stories. Have you struck it lucky in the NT? 0487 99 1057 is the text number here at the Country Hour. We're off prospecting before 1:30. Hope you can stick around for that. Broadcasting right across the territory on the ABC. And g'day if you've tuned in via the podcast. International and Australian business leaders and investors have been in Darwin this week for the inaugural NT Investment Summit. This big event, it's been organised by the Territory Government and the Darwin Major Business Group. And one of the people invited to this summit is Craig Doyle, the boss of the Northern Australia Infrastructure Facility, a.k.a. the NAIF. He spoke to Fiona Broom about what he thinks this summit has achieved.
Yeah, I think it's a great initiative, to be honest, Fiona. I think they've targeted both domestic and international visitors and investors. And, you know, NAIF's obviously a big investor across Northern Australia as well. But, look, they've done a really good job at what I see in terms of who they've invited and really trying to target, you know, selling what Northern Territory opportunity is. But the people who ultimately will finance these projects seem to be here at the summit.
Who is here?
Yeah, I wouldn't be able to name them all. Obviously, there's obviously key. I went on the agricultural tour yesterday, and we had the ambassador for Malaysia and Indonesia. I sat next to the ambassador for Indonesia on the tour yesterday. So they've really targeted, and I saw the Consulate General of India this morning. So they've really targeted those countries who, you know, probably have a key linkage to investment in Australia or some of our goods that might come out of the Northern Territory and products that might be interested in, you know, being offtake partners or investors in those type of projects.
Yeah, the Northern Territory has big export links with Indonesia in particular. Was there anything that those ambassadors were interested in during that tour yesterday?
Yeah, the ag tour was fantastic. And I think that's what I'm very impressed about this summit. They're actually taking people out rather than just sitting in a room and towing pictures. We actually went out to an operating station that's diversified into high quality accommodation as well. And I think that was very interesting for the ambassadors that, who were talking and asking questions. And they raised some really good points about how keen they are to work with Australia, and particularly Northern Territory, given the geographical advantage that it has here into Indonesia and Southeast Asia. So, yeah, very, very keen to learn. And that tour yesterday had five, you know, successful Northern Territory agricultural businesses that are already successful in their own right, but also looking to expand. And I think it was very good that real people who know what the challenges and the opportunities are the ones who are presenting to the tour group, which is fantastic.
What have you been spruiking investment-wise for Northern Australia?
Yeah, well, I'm speaking this afternoon with some other financiers as well. Look, for us, you know, we're obviously a financier, as you would know. I think for us is making sure anybody who wants to potentially invest or do a project in Northern Territory or Northern Australia, we're here. We're not a typical bank. We're not interested in profit margins. We're interested in public benefits and jobs and Indigenous outcomes. So, you know, we've been set up because we know how hard it is to fund projects in Northern Australia. So I think my message will be just a bit of a sell, particularly those international visitors who to know what we are, but also, you know, I think all the projects that we're involved here in Northern Territory or across Northern Australia now, Fiona. It's not going to take one party like NAIF or anyone else to solve the problems. It's going to be a collaborative effort of multiple financiers, multiple proponents. The government's got to play its role, federal and territory. So I think that's my message. It's not a, if it was easy that one party could do it, it would already be done. We've got to make sure we collaborate.
So would NAIF work with foreign investors, international investors?
Absolutely. I won't give you a percentage because I'll get it wrong, but I would say the majority of our projects have international investment on either the equity or the debt side, as well as Australian. So absolutely, we're very, very keen to make sure, you know, funding comes from multiple sources to de-risk the project, and that's great for the proponent. So absolutely.
The last project that was funded here in the Northern Territory by NAIF was the Nolans Bore project in January 2024. I think prior to that it was 2021, and then a few projects 2018, 2019, 2020. Have you got any big projects to announce while you're here in Darwin?
Oh, I'd love to, Fiona. All I'd say is stay tuned. There's a couple of projects deep into our investment process, so not to investment decision yet, and there's a couple in Northern Territory that hopefully next time I see you or you're here in the near term, hopefully we can announce some of those. So look, we'd always like to do more. I mean, my message is we're not capped. We're agnostic in terms of the infrastructure we can fund. We've done some great projects here. I think I've got in my slide pack this afternoon, I think there's something like six or so projects in our pre-investment pipeline worth $420 million of loan value, and $2 billion of projects are the ones that we just talked about that are coming through. And that's not everybody we're talking to. That's just the ones that are starting to get deep into our process. So stay tuned.
Not capped, as in you're not capped at a financial limit?
We're not really capped at a finance. We've got $7 billion total appropriation, of which we've committed $4.3 billion, so there's still $2.7 billion there. And I'd be pretty confident to say I might get in trouble, but if we end up lending $7 billion, I'm sure we'll get some more, because it means we must be investing in great projects across the north.
You are working across particular sectors, though. I understand agriculture, the energy spaces in particular.
Yeah, look, we're sector agnostic. I think I looked at it last night, to be honest, Fiona, and some of the sectors that we probably haven't been able to crack is digital, some of the cabling and digital, but we've got some data centre people starting to talk us across the north. Look, energy, we're already quite heavy in. We've done the Bachelor Solar Farm and the Hudson Creek Gas and Solar here. We've done some solar over in Western Australia, and we've got Australia, which will be Australia's first pumped hydro project in 40 years, coming online next year. It's our largest loan with $610 million in Queensland. So we're very keen on energy, and that doesn't have to be just the conventional solar, wind, pumped hydro. We're talking about batteries, and we've just started to talk to some people, not in the territory at the moment, around waste to energy type projects as well. So we're very agnostic about what type of projects we can look at.
And there was an independent review which was tabled a few months ago, or released to the Minister for Northern Australia a few months ago. It's, as I understand, not publicly available yet, but is NAIF functioning the way it should?
Oh, look, I'm probably a bit biased, but look, I think we've worked very hard in the last few years to make sure that we are, and I think one of those, and it's for other peoples to judge, and I think the task force report, which I believe will be tabled shortly, you know, hopefully that's, you know, very positive about what we're doing okay, but more importantly, what else we can do for the north, and that's what we're very, you know, keen to see and understand. I think, you know, to give an idea, I think it took us, been around for about 8 years now, Fiona, I think it took us about 6 years, or just over 6 years, to put the first $1 billion of physical money out the door, which really, it's not until the money goes out that you see the benefits. In the last 3 years, we've been averaging $600 million a year out the door. So last year was about $550 million. So I think if you judge us on actually getting the money out, which means you get all those benefits, that's where we've really picked up, and we're starting to do more. We're taking a higher risk appetite, which we're playing with public money, so we need to be careful on that. But, you know, the board's been fantastic. We've just backed what I think is Australia's largest modular housing project in Queensland as well. So we're starting to play in accommodation space where we can. So, yeah, we're very, very keen to do more, and we can always do better.
NAIF's funding or operational period runs out in about a year. It's the 30th of June 2026. Still $2.3 billion, I think you said, left in the kitty. What happens over the next year, and what happens after mid-next year?
Yeah, well, that's the task force report that, as you rightfully said, I think it was the independent task force gave the report to the minister in February or March. Then this little thing called an election got in the way. So I think it's got to be tabled, you know, within the next 6 weeks, I think, under the legislation. Look, I think once that comes out, I think there'll be a lot of surety about what the task force has recommended. And then obviously we need to see the government's response. But I will say that, you know, we've had great support from this government. Even though you mentioned Murray Watt 3 years ago, that same government's now popped us up from 5 to 7 billion a couple of years ago, named us in the Future Made in Australia, named us in the Critical Mineral Strategy. We're a heavy lender in the critical mineral rare earths, including Arafura, which you mentioned. So I think, you know, we've turned them around on what we can do, and hopefully we're starting to do a better job, but more importantly, we can do even more for the North.
That is Craig Doyle, who's the chief executive of the NAIF, the Northern Australia Infrastructure Facility. He was speaking to Fiona Broom this morning. Craig's been involved in the inaugural NT Investment Summit, and that is probably the only interview that we will be getting from that event. It's very much an invite-only event. From what I can tell, the media have not been allowed to go along to the convention centre and listen to the presentations and get involved and report on it, which is unusual. I see the NT Independent, which is an online news publication. It's written an article about this. I'll just share a few lines with you this afternoon. So it's reporting that the CLP government has launched its first NT Investment Summit in Darwin, bringing to town over 100 business leaders, investors and key stakeholders, but has not disclosed the cost to taxpayers of the summit or details about what is actually being discussed. The NT Independent has got quotes here from Kirsty Howie from the Environment Centre NT. She says taxpayers have every right to ask questions about these backroom summits and conferences when the territory is $13 billion in debt. She says people are tired of being kept in the dark while being fed endless spin about the supposed economic benefits of fracking, offshore gas and mining. She says ministers' diaries still have not been made public, and now we find, without any good reason, that basic details like agendas for publicly funded conferences are being kept hidden, says Kirsty Howie via the NT Independent. And from what I can tell, it's accurate that the program details were not made public. We're very grateful of being able to speak to Craig Doyle. That was handy. It's 18 to 1 and you are tuned into the Country Hour, making national rural news. Maybe you've seen this. An award-winning farmer from Queensland has been jailed over an $8.7 million water fraud. I'll share the details of this case with you straight after a tune by Troy Cassidaly. It is 14 to 1 and you are tuned into the Country Hour. Matt Brown with you this afternoon. A Queensland cotton farmer has been sentenced to 9.5 years in prison for his role in a multi-million dollar water fraud. John Norman pleaded guilty to fraudulently claiming $8.7 million from the Healthy Headwaters Scheme, a program that was set up to encourage water efficiency in the Murray-Darling Basin. Brandon Long was at the sentencing yesterday and spoke to Megan Hughes about what's happened.
So John Norman was accused of fraudulently inducing money from a water efficiency program. It was called Healthy Headwaters, and it was a Commonwealth government scheme that was overseen by the state government. The court heard that Norman received almost $20 million through the scheme, including about $8.7 million in fraudulent claims. So John Norman was a respected cotton grower in the Toobeer district, which is just west of Gundawindi on the Queensland-New South Wales border. He grew other crops as well, and at the peak of the family's empire, they controlled about 18,000 hectares, and they were mainly a cropping operation, as I mentioned, and involving various family members, contractors, and also several, you know, employees. And in court yesterday, the judge said that there were two employees who were caught up in this, and more than 10 contractors who were pressured to falsify documents.
Now, in the end, Norman pleaded guilty, but it did take some time to reach this point, didn't it?
Yes, that's right. So Between 2010 and 2016, Norman and his former chief financial officer were pressuring contractors to alter these invoices. Then in 2017, police raided the property as part of a criminal investigation, and there were some delays to the investigation. The judge mentioned yesterday that some documents weren't initially provided, but were later provided, and that delayed the proceedings for around about a year. And while the judge did say that you know, was, you know, somewhat of a factor in this, he didn't really take it into consideration when handing down a sentence. Now, the co-accused, as I mentioned, was a chief financial officer who worked there for some time and was caught up in all of this. He pleaded guilty early on in the piece and received a four-year sentence and spent 9 months in prison. But Norman, basically, the legal proceedings continued for years and years, and he pleaded guilty just this year, and that's when we've seen the majority of the action take place. Detective Superintendent Troy Pakalis led the Rural Crime and Stock Squad during the investigation. He told me it was a complex case.
I think it's reflective of the complexity of the case. I'd like to acknowledge the perseverance and the dedication of the case officers for this matter. It really shows the value of having specialist rural investigators in our rural areas. As the judge said, to deconstruct and reconcile those records and documents to uncover that really intricate deception that Norman undertook for such a long period of time, I think that 9.5 years is certainly consistent with that sort of offending. The judge compared it to Ponzi schemes and insurance fraud and that sort of thing, and said it was quite a unique one.
It sounds like it was actually, yeah, incredibly complex for the police to be able to unravel what Norman had done. What else did the judge have to say during sentencing?
Yes, well, he made it clear that this Healthy Headwater scheme was to allow irrigators to basically apply for money to improve their irrigation infrastructure on the properties in exchange for a portion of that water savings to be transferred to the government for environmental use. And in that context, he said that Norman involved his contractors and employees in this, benefiting only himself and his enterprises at their expense, and in doing so he brought an important public water program into disrepute and undermined faith in public administration. Yesterday, Judge Porter said Norman had exploited the small family businesses, singling out one husband and wife operation in particular who had been contracted to do general farm work, and pressured by Norman to change their invoice so it could be claimed as part of Healthy Headwaters. And having completed this work and under financial pressure, they complied with Norman. And now, during the legal proceedings, Norman was diagnosed with ADHD, and his defence claimed this had had played a role in his fraudulent claims. But Judge Porter said he couldn't accept it had any mitigating effect on the offence. He basically said that Norman had ample opportunity to become aware of his record keeping and organisational shortcomings. So Judge Porter sentenced Norman to a maximum of 9.5 years in prison over his role in one of Australia's most significant water frauds. And he will spend the next 3 years in prison, eligible for parole in 2028. Detective Superintendent Troy Pakalis says the case has taken a toll on the community.
We know personally that the mental health of witnesses and people in the community that were either third parties or indirectly involved have been impacted on it. The reputation of both the cotton industry, farmers and people associated with those small communities has taken some sort of taken a bit of a hit, you know. And that's a long-lasting effect, and that shouldn't be understated. Even though the offender and his family may have moved from the area, and you know, the judge commented on that today, the fact is that those people still live in those communities, and it certainly would have been a taint from this fraudulent offending.
You've been part of the rural community, being in the stock squad, and those tight-knit communities don't seem to forget these sorts of things.
Absolutely not. No, that is, you know, having seen the resilience and the, I guess, the collaboration that those communities go through all the time, particularly when they're responding to disasters or responding to events like this, where I guess the community's threatened in a different way, like their reputation and how people view them, it does really impact on them.
That is Troy Pakalis, who is from Queensland Police. He was speaking to Brandon Long about this landmark case. If you've just tuned in, what we're talking about here is an award-winning farmer from Queensland who's just been jailed and has been sentenced to 9.5 years in prison for his role in a multi-million dollar water fraud. You can read more about this right now if you head along to the ABC Rural website.
Hey, my name's Joe Brown. I'm one of the competitors here at Daily Waters Camp Drafting Radio, and you're listening to the Country Hour.
It is 5 to 1 on a Thursday lunchtime. You are tuned into the Country Hour. A moment ago, I was telling you a bit about the inaugural NT Investment Summit, which has been held in Darwin this week. It's been organised by the Territory Government and the Darwin Major Business Group. It's a very exclusive event, invite only. I mentioned how it seems the media has not been allowed into the convention centre this week to sit in and listen to the presentations. We're joined this afternoon by Luke Gosling, who's the federal member for Solomon. He's also the federal government's special envoy for Northern Australia. Did you get into the convention centre for the inaugural NT Investment Summit, Luke?
Oh, g'day, Matt. No, unfortunately, it was too exclusive. The Minister for Northern Australia, Madeleine King, was invited but couldn't make it. So she asked that I represent her, which, of course, I was very happy to do, given that it's a Northern Territory event being held here in Darwin. But a lot of stakeholders, unfortunately, because I wasn't invited, even though I sort of suggested that it would be a good idea, given that the federal government's interest is very interesting to private investors that they've attracted here. So what's happened over the last few days is I've been meeting with stakeholders separate to the summit, and that's been good. But I thought it was a little bit short-sighted from the NT government not to involve what is, you know, arguably the biggest investor in the Northern Territory, being the federal government.
So do you just shrug your shoulders and say, oh, well, that's, you know, they can do whatever they want to do. You've met people on the side, so happy days. Or is this uncommon?
I would have thought it was a bit short-sighted and uncommon, given our role. Yeah, we've got the NAIF here, which is good, but on the sidelines, yeah, I've been meeting with the NAIF, Infrastructure Australia, Engineers Australia, ambassadors from several countries. So that's been good. Have I just make the observation that often it's a private sector that want to see that the federal government is not only actively interested and investing, but they want to have the discussions about how we can all work together as a bit of a team territory approach. So there's been some worthwhile discussions, but it's just curious around the exclusivity and the secrecy around this particular event.
Here at the Country Hour, we were very grateful that we at least got to speak to Craig Doyle from the NAIF, albeit outside the grounds. Just on the NAIF, it's been about 18 months since any NAIF money flowed into the Northern Territory. Is that good enough, Luke Gosling?
Yeah, well, because there's a lot in the pipeline coming through. And that was confirmed by Craig, who's doing a fantastic job running the NAIF. So there's more to come, and obviously you've already talked about the stuff that has been confirmed by the NAIF. I've introduced them to some local proponents just in the last few days, and so there'll be more positive news coming from federal investment. And obviously you'd be aware that we're also contributing $50 million into the small loans element that we're providing to the NT government, so they're able to do that, you know, up to $10 million type projects. So we're investing in the Northern Territory, whether it be the smaller loans up to 10 mil or through the NAIF in over 10 mil programs. And there's some good news coming, as Craig said, just in relation to the task force report that will be tabled in the Parliament in the coming parliamentary sittings.
Okay.
Maybe not this next one that starts next week, because that's largely ceremonial in terms of the new parliament being sworn in, and we've obviously got the 20% student debt legislation, some childcare legislation that is the priority. But legislatively, in the August.
We've got to go here, sorry, Luke Gosling, because it's news time on the ABC. But appreciate your time. Yeah. Our door's always open here at the Country Hour, so thank you so much for your time. That is Luke Gosling. News time, see you back here in 5 minutes for a chat with the Weather Bureau.
I'm Denny.
I'm Bridie.
I'm Eric.
I'm Bridget.
I'm Gage.
We're from Dungan Station, and you're listening to the Country Hour.
Matt Brown with you this afternoon. In a moment, I've got some good news for mango growers and mango fans. Researchers reckon they've found a cheap and easy way to extend the shelf life of mangoes by an extra 2 weeks. And as the price of gold goes up and up and up, prospectors in the territory are grabbing the pans and they're grabbing the metal detectors, looking to strike it rich.
There's a lot of gold coming in, but people are scattered everywhere across the territory. There's a lot of people with leases. There's a lot of people out at migrant diggings and those sorts of places. Now it's the season, so don't really hear much.
We're off prospecting before 1:30. I hope you can stick around for that. And we're hearing from you this afternoon on 0487 99 1057. Just before the 1 o'clock news, we were talking about this inaugural NT Investment Summit being held in Darwin this week. Very invite only. The media have not been allowed to go along and listen to the presentations. And turns out even the federal member for Solomon and the special envoy for Northern Australia, Luke Gosling, he didn't get a ticket to it either. James in Willagi this afternoon says, Matt, Luke Gosling has been on every radio station bagging out the CLP over the last 6 months. And then he wonders why he didn't get a Guernsey to the investment summit. Cheers from James. And Frog in Wagamon this afternoon says, gee, wonder why they didn't want Luke Gosling there. Spin bowler at Shane Warne type levels, says Frog. I'll always read out a text with a cricket reference. I'll give you the tip. Love that. Let's go to the Weather Bureau. Sally Cutter's there this afternoon. How are you, Sally?
Oh, not too bad, thanks.
Ever done any gold panning, metal detecting, anything like that in your time?
I might have tried some gold panning. Mum and Dad were keen on it at one stage, before my time. They'd go gold panning up around the Walhalla Way.
Right. We had a real busted sort of metal detector on the farm growing up, but I had a lot of fun going around the paddocks, always found leftover wire, tops of beer bottles, and one day I found a penny, which, I thought I'd struck it rich.
Yeah.
I had not, but that was more exciting than finding fencing wire. The idea of just scanning a paddock and all of a sudden actually finding a nugget of gold, wouldn't you be
ecstatic.
Oh, yeah.
Especially at the current gold price, which I'm just bringing up here on my computer so I can share it with you and everyone else, Sally. So today the Aussie gold price is sitting at over $5,150 per ounce.
Ooh.
I felt like we only 2 years ago were doing stories of like, ooh, it's just hit 3,000.
Yeah.
Now it's 5,150. Time to get the pan back out, Sally Cutter.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty sure they're still in the shed somewhere. So probably just need to brush off and hope they haven't rusted through.
Let's talk weather. Is it a good day to be out there prospecting? Nice conditions?
Sunny. It's a little bit humid. That's probably the main issue if you're out there. But temperatures aren't actually that high. We're looking around Darwin, we're not even up to that 20, and even right across the rural area. Our Bachelor's 31, Nux Lagoon 31, but Middle Point 31. It's the coast, more coastal. It's still sub 30, helped by the fact the sea breezes come in. But if you're a bit further afield, even Catherine's only 30 degrees. Tennant Creek 24. So Alice Springs is 17, so if you're out in the East Max, probably not too bad. Northern's a bit humid, southern probably fairly pleasant.
Okay, and that southeasterly surge, whereabouts is it? What's it up to?
It's not overly strong. We've just got a little bit of a pulse coming in through the coastal waters and a bit of dry air on the weekend. But generally, it's not a very significant one. It's more the trough coming through next week.
Which brings with it the possibility of a little bit of rain. What's the latest there, Sally Cutter?
Well, we've sort of got two things happening. One, we've got a trough moving through and picking the winds up through the Leicester and Southern Tanami, so that's going with dry air, so that's going to increase the fire dangers there. And then that it moves through to Monday night, Tuesday, really dropping the temperatures down, so even up to about 9 degrees, and increasing rain associated with that trough. That sort of weakens then to Wednesday, becomes sort of this hybrid day where you've got the first trough moving on, the cloud bands are weakening, but then you get a thicker cloud band developing during Wednesday and into Thursday, and with the mid-level winds turning that northwesterly. There is another little trough, surface trough moving through that's associated with it, but as the low moves across the south, but that's the one that's going to produce rainfall. The first one, maybe a few millimetres, but this one, it looks like it's up to potentially 20 mils a day. So we might see about 50 across the 3 or 4 days of it.
Whoa.
Yeah.
I feel like this forecast has gone up a notch compared to 24 hours ago.
They're still talking.
No, I don't think Kyle was giving us as generous millimetres as you are today.
But was he talking beginning of the week or end of the week?
Yeah, he's talking like middle week, middle of next week, all would be revealed.
Yeah, this is more Thursday, Friday end. Thursday, Friday,
up to 50 millimetres possible.
For the whole week or the whole period for that cloud band. So that one, I think probably what's happening is the first one's moisting the air up.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one's taking advantage. But it is a week out, and we do sometimes see these rainfall totals decrease as we get closer. So, but it's... there's a
too late, Sally. I'm excited.
It's too late.
Yep. Cat's out of the bag. We love it. We'll be keeping an eye on that. Now, we're also keeping an eye on Catherine. Show day tomorrow and Saturday. I've got here a top tomorrow of 31 degrees, a low of 11, and on Saturday a low of 10, top of 31 again. Should be pretty nice. What's the wind going to do at the Catherine Show?
Oh, it's not going to be too bad. Tomorrow's probably going to be the windier day. We are seeing a little bit of dry air getting in, so it's going to be just a little bit drier through there. But generally, we're just looking at those moderate winds, so it's not going to be too blowy.
Okay. Thanks so much for your time, Sally.
That's okay.
It's 12 past one. You are tuned into the Country Hour. Just quickly, Bushfires NT and the Northern Territory Fire and Rescue Service have today declared a fire danger period for the Savannah Fire Management Zone. Pretty big chunk of country that includes townships such as Larimer, Catherine, Mataranka, Timber Creek, Kalkarindji and Dargaragu. For more information, check out the Bushfires NT
webpage.
Grab the August issue of Gardening Australia for expert tips on growing kangaroo paw, bare-rooted ornamentals, eggplant and potted citrus. Plus, identify weedy plants, learn about potting mix and visit an urban food forest.
If you're in the mango industry, or you just love eating mangoes, stop what you're doing and have a listen to this. Researchers from Edith Cowan University have found a way to extend the shelf life of mangoes by an extra 2 weeks. Lecturer Dr. Michaela Vitterner is the research lead on all of this, and she says the good news, especially for growers, is that the solution they've come up with is simple and it's pretty cheap.
We found that by dipping Kensington red mangoes in ozonated water for 10 minutes before storage at 5 degrees Celsius for like 28 days, we can reduce chilling injury by about 40% compared to untreated mangoes. And that is much longer than their current storage life of 2 weeks. So this is like a good finding.
So can you explain to me how this process actually works? And what is this actual process of I want to pronounce this right, ozonization?
Yes, that is the scientific term. It's just bubbling ozone into water through an ozone generator. And it's a very simple technology. It's just like you dip ozone generator, there's a bubbling device, and you dip that into water, and then it makes it ozonated. That is what we do here.
So is it a bit like, I'm trying to relate this maybe, is it a bit like, you know, sparkling water, something like that?
Yes, it's something like that. Yes, it's just ozone. That's the difference.
And so, you know, how much of a difference does this make? An additional 2 weeks of shelf life, how much of a difference does that make in terms of food waste?
By extending this shelf life, we can significantly reduce food loss because, as you know, mangoes ripe so fast, really fastly. And then that is associated with food loss as well as it is associated with lots of carbon footprint because a lot of resources are being already used to produce these mangoes. So we can reduce this food loss as well as carbon footprint by extending the storage life for, say, even by 1 week. There is a huge reduction in food loss. So I think this is a significant loss that we can save.
Who stands to benefit the most from this study? Would it be the mango growers themselves?
Mango growers as well as the traders and consumers also. Even if you like can keep mangoes long at your kitchen, then that can help the consumers as well. So all growers, traders, consumers, everybody can benefit from this research.
What should mango growers do with this? Should they then look at purchasing one of these devices?
Yes, actually, it is not a very, very costly thing. These ozone generators, you can buy a simple portable one for a couple hundred dollars. Oh. And there are sophisticated ones for a few thousand dollars. So it's not a hugely like sophisticated technology that you cannot afford. It can be afforded by like almost all the growers. But one key point that they should remember is we have to bubble ozone into clean tap water. Not that dirty water, because dirty water can reduce the ozone activity. So if they can bubble this ozonated bubble ozone into clean tap water, they can use this easily.
That is Dr. Michaela Vitterner from Edith Cowan University speaking to Charlie Mills about this new research that can improve the shelf life of mangoes by 2 weeks.
It's a solar farm, wind farm, and a battery farm, and it was the first of its kind in the world. How did it end up in a small town in outback Queensland? Find out on Landline, Sunday, 12:30 on ABC TV and iView.
And the Marker Report, Pip. How good is the Marker Report? On the Country Hour today, we've been talking about the inaugural NT Investment Summit. It's been a big event, but not for everyone. Media hasn't been allowed along, as far as we can tell. And we spoke earlier to Luke Gosling, the federal member for Solomon, who was unable to get an invite as well. On the text this afternoon, 0487 991057, Di in Nightcliffe says, Matt, I don't have a cricket reference, sorry. That's fine, Di. It's not a prerequisite. I just love cricket references.
Di has been listening this afternoon and says this action by the CLP government sounds a bit like a dictatorship. 18 past one. Let's go prospecting next.
G'day, I'm Toby. I'm Cotton Dinner in Northern Territory. You're listening to The Country Hour.
Yeah, let's talk about gold. As you know, the gold price has been at record highs this year, going above 5,000 Aussie dollars per ounce. And as I found out, it's got the prospecting community in the Northern Territory very excited and very busy.
G'day, it's Mick from Top End Prospecting in Coolalinga. How are you?
Mick, tell us your story. How did you get into the world of prospecting?
Well, that was back in the Pilbara, I suppose. I was had a seafood restaurant in Point Sampson and, cooking. And then a few friends said, oh, we're going out prospecting. I thought, I'll come and dig your holes. I need a break from the kitchen. And it went out to Marble Bar. And that's when I found my first piece, a 14-ouncer, with a borrowed detector. And that was it. I was hooked.
What'd you do that afternoon after finding 14 ounces?
We actually stayed there because we were dropped off and camp was a fair bit away. I was with a mate, Chook, and we had a couple of Coronas, but there was more gold there. 14 ounce, I wasn't the only one. I picked up a 2 ounce or a 3 ounce. It's just in a creek. And then Chook was there. He was going hard, so we had a good handful by the time they come from camp and picked us up. Got on the phone, got the missus to order me one of the latest detectors, then a 4500. But yeah, no, I went back to the kitchen, but then my pastime then went from fishing, because we were in a fishing village there, to, any opportunity, get back out to the and get out there, give them a hand and have a detect, and never stopped then.
And so what's your biggest find now? Is it still the 14 ounce?
No, when I left the Pilbara and went over to Victoria, I was lucky enough to dig up a 2.7 kilo nugget.
2.7. What's that in ounces?
It was an 87.7 ouncer called the Fair Dinkum Nugget, we called it. That was quite a big find. It was on the news. It was all over the show back then. Hyped everybody up, That was a good find. I was in Wedderburn in Victoria. People come from everywhere to have a hold and have a look. And
wow.
Yeah, that was good.
Did you keep that nugget for long or sell it?
No, I still had some outstanding debts from the from the restaurant, so pretty much helped out, paid off everything that I needed to pay off and validated my reason for prospecting in the family. No one could argue with me then.
So what brought you to the Territory then?
Victoria had enough there and thought, bugger it, let's... My brother's up here, he's got a restaurant out at Cullen Bay, and so I thought, we'll come up and see him, give it a bit of a hand. It's cold down there, and it was a struggle.
Especially at this time of year.
Oh, crikey, and chopping wood, and saying, oh, God, it's got to be better. And Ben grew up in the Pilbara, so I like the heat. And then I come up with my daughter, and then we thought, let's hang out. So I went back into Chefham for a bit. And went out to Impex like everybody else. And then opportunity come up for this. And I've always worked with Minelab since the big nugget. Always been in communications with them. Mm. And they were like, come on, guy, you're up there. So then I thought, I'll bugger it and give it a shot. From Mr. Goldfinger.
If you're tuning in, this is The Country Hour. And we're speaking to Mick from Top End Prospecting. Tell us about the prospecting community in the Northern Territory. How big is it?
There's quite a few crew here when it comes down to it. Like, the shop's busy. We've got the association now, NT Prospectors and Detectorists. There's quite a lot of members on that, a lot of communication, a lot of bits and pieces that happen on that. A lot of proactive people that want to get together, want to learn more. I mean, when you're thinking prospecting, it's not necessarily just going out bush looking for gold or treasures. It's more, there's also geology, understanding the ground, where it's likely, where you're going to find gold.
The gold price doing what it's doing, just constantly breaking records.
Yeah.
Has that spurred on extra prospecting?
Yeah, well, it sort of has. A lot of people are interested. You know, the decisions in some people gets made, like every weekend I put the boat in the water and we go fishing. And that costs me, so much. The boat costs so much. Fuel costs so much. Oil costs so much. Bait, you know, go from a $7 block of muleys, I think they're up to about $30 or something now. And they start to think, bloody hell, crikey, you know, this is becoming expensive. Whereas with gold, you're out bush. Yeah, you've got to outlay the money for a detector. And you don't want to buy something cheap or something that might just, raise your chances a bit. You really got to go to the top, get what everybody's using, and get out there so you're not wasting time. But you come home with money, in most cases. Sometimes people don't.
Mm. In terms of metal detectors, like without mentioning too many brand names, what's the most expensive detector on the market? How much are people forking out?
Well, when you're going for the top of the wazzer, you're not wasting your time out bush. You're giving yourself the best opportunity is basically the Minelab 7000 or 6000. The 7000's worth $10,799 now.
Over $10,000.
Yep.
So hang on a minute, if you find 2 ounces, you've paid it off.
Basically. Well, considering gold price now. Yeah. You know, with that machine, with the tech, you're going to where gold was found. So where old mate found gold with an older machine a long time ago, and everyone said, oh, he's already been there years ago, it's all gone. The technology now, they're going back to those places and just picking up more gold.
How deep are the new models detecting? How deep?
It's sort of, the depth is on the size of the target that you're digging.
Mm-hmm.
So from what I've seen and what I've done personally, basically, you know, I've dug a nugget the size of my thumbnail, which could be sort of round, weirdly shaped, flat, and the deepest then I've seen something like that would be like 800 mil, 750 mil. But gold's weird. The machine picks up on the frequencies that the gold puts out. So that's what the machine's looking for. So sometimes gold, you know, isn't really charged. It's not putting out so you don't pick it up with the earlier machines. So as they've got technology now, it's searching a broader frequency range, which then is bringing the gold that other machines didn't hear to life. So that's why you can go back to where old mate found a lot of gold back in the day, and go back in there and wow, and just start digging, and you think, how's this? It's technology.
Yeah. And so if I wanted to get into prospecting, what are the rules I need to be aware of?
Well, in other states, you get a miner's right. That's not necessary here in the territory. If you want to go, say, to a company that has leases on ground, you send them an email, mm-hmm. and ask for permission to get out there, basically. There is dedicated fossicking grounds here, you know, that they're available from the Mines Department, Margaret Diggings and Spring Hill. So you can go up to the Mines Department and get permission to go to those places. And then the other rules is...
There was someone in the shop just a moment ago wanting to know more about what's around Pine Creek.
Yeah, and want to know more, and you sort of, you know, go up there, have a look. And then you've got the ability to go on to Strike. Strike will show you where all the leases are, will show you who own them, and then you can go from there, fill out for permission. The other rules are sort of like rules that we all abide by is, you know, you dig a hole for a bit of gold, you fill the hole in. You take all your rubbish with you. You camp clean, and, you know, if you get permission to go out to an area, you leave the gates the way they are. You know, basically, when you leave that campsite, it's like you've never been there.
Still plenty of gold in the territory, is there, Mick?
There's a lot of gold coming in, but people are scattered everywhere across the territory. There's a lot of people with leases. There's a lot of people out at Margaret Diggings and those sorts of places, people with permission to get out onto properties. Now it's the season, so don't really hear much.
Been good talking gold with you today, Mick. Thanks for your time on the Country Hour.
Yeah, no worries. Have a good one. Cheers, mate.
Yeah, big thanks to Mick Brown. Country Hour's got a little bit of gold fever this afternoon. I've got a text from someone wanting to know what he sold that nugget for. he mentioned how it was all over the news back in the day, and it was. So back in 2015, Mick sold what was called the Fair Dinkum Nugget. It was 87 ounces, as he said. According to the first article I've found from Channel 9, it said, a man who found a 2.7-kilo gold nugget after his wife booted him out of the house for being grumpy has sold it for $175,000. That was back in 2015, right, for a nugget that was 87 ounces. So it sold back then for $175,000. That same nugget today, at today's Aussie gold price, would sell for a bit over $448,000. Catherine's show is on tomorrow. The Country Hour will be there to bring you all of the action. There's already plenty of camp drafting going on as part of this event. Lots of people getting involved in the Territory Cup camp draft there at the Catherine Showgrounds. And already few winners. Well done to Brenton Gorman, who took out the encouragement draft. The junior workout was won by Mac Harris. Mac, how big's your trophy cabinet, young man? Isla Scott took out the juvenile draft. The mini workout was won by Paisley Ford. And Oliver McGilvray from Avern has taken out the dry work pattern. Well done to everyone there. Country Hour at the Catherine Show tomorrow. Look forward to that. Keep it rural.